All right, Tuesday night Bible study, the Gospel of John. We're going to get started in the first half of John chapter 19 tonight. And if you remember, in chapter 18, Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane. There was a group led by Judas, a group of soldiers. I think they were temple guard. And they arrest Jesus, and then he's put on trial. And during the trial, we hear about Peter's denial. And the third time, the rooster crowed. And during the process of all that, Jesus is then taken to Pontius Pilate. And there's a conversation between Pilate and Jesus about whether he's king or what is the truth. Oh, hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
Oh, it's fine. We just started. Pilate was, in chapter 18, Pilate was trying to release Jesus. But rather, the crowd called for what? Barabbas. They wanted Barabbas instead of Jesus. So Barabbas, and I like this, how the Gospel of John is so full of these double meanings, double entendres, hidden meanings underneath. Barabbas is the first person to be, shall we say, rescued by Jesus? The substituted for Jesus? Jesus is the substitute? He is for all of us, of course, but particularly that happened with Barabbas, and it's the first of the fulfillment of Jesus' purpose, to save mankind. There it is. All right, I think that's about where chapter 18 ends, isn't it? Oh, what is this? Chapter 18. So let's see, chapter 18 ends... Yeah, right there. Not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. And remember, we talked about robber, because the other Gospels talk about him being a murderer and an insurrectionist. And so, what's the answer? Which is he? Do the Gospels contradict each other? No. The answer is he was all three. He had quite a rep. All right. Chapter 19, verse 1. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. By the way, doesn't this seem a little bit ironic, but actually in a good way, that here we are on the threshold of Christmas and we're talking about Jesus' crucifixion? Did I mention that last time we met? That it must have been the Wednesday class. I'm glad I'm mentioning it here. It just seems weird. It seemed weird to me at first. It's like, you know, Christmas is a cute and cuddly holiday, right? And here we're talking about Jesus being flogged and crucified. But that's the whole point, reason he was born. So there is kind of an interesting timing here that I didn't intend. It just happened that way. That we're about to celebrate Jesus' birthday, and here we are in Bible study talking about Jesus' death. So Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. Now, probably all of you know or remember from somewhere in your studies in the past that was no simple task. The Romans knew how to flog somebody. And they would use a cat of nine tails, and on the end of each of the little strands on the whip, there was, you remember, a little barb or a piece of bone or a piece of stone woven into it, attached to it. So as a prisoner or victim would be flogged, it would kind of rip across their back and open long wounds, and of course draw a lot of blood. It would tear the flesh. Many times victims would die from a Roman flogging. It was so severe. And so, you know, they would, being whipped into an inch of their life or inch of their death. Yes, that was something that was known to happen. Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. Now, we know from the other, Gospels that they talk about that, Pilate has said, I will punish him and then release him. Now we know from all the Gospels, Pilate gets the sense he knows Jesus is innocent. We heard that in the previous chapter here in the Gospel of John. Pilate knows Jesus is innocent, right? He says, I find no guilt in him. So, but Pilate is in this political pickle. He's kind of in a spot. So he wants to release Jesus. He knows that's what is right, but the Jewish leaders are putting all this pressure on him. And so in the other Gospels, he says, I will punish him and then release him. The idea being that, well, he's not going to be killed or crucified, but by flogging him, he maybe can gain the sympathy of the crowd. The crowd will say, oh, okay, look at this Jesus. He's been thoroughly punished. He doesn't need to be killed. So I think, now this is just Pastor Measle kind of reading a little bit into this. I think the reason Pilate flogged Jesus was not out of some sense of animosity or cruelty or punishment. Pilate flogged Jesus to try and gain sympathy from the crowd and release Jesus. That's what he was looking at. After being flogged, verse 2, the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. Crown of thorns. Nobody knows what kind of thorns they were. There are different bushes and plants that would have thorns. They could have been as short as an inch or as long as like 3 inches. But whatever the case, you know, you weave together a crown of thorns, and then they would have probably taken a stick or something to put it on his head because it'd be so pokey. So they pushed that on his head. So what's that going to do? Well, that's going to hurt. Poke a lot throughout his scalp, and blood will be starting to come down his head then. And arrayed him in a purple robe. Have I talked with this class at all about purple versus red? I don't know if you've ever wondered that. A couple of the other Gospels say that they put Jesus in a red robe and then mocked him as king. Here it says purple robe. And I remember that. So I looked up both the words in Greek. They are different words. And the one means red, and the other one means purple or violet. So again, here's one of those questions. Which is it? Is it purple or is it red? And here again, you know, people who might say, oh, see, your gospel message, your Bible contradicts itself. And I would say, no, different people have different perceptions of the same color. You know, you know, Jill will say, okay, we're going to repaint this room. What color are we going to paint it? White. And she will say, okay, what color white? You know, ecru or eggshell or off-white or ivory or bone or whatever, and you know, all these different colors of white. Here's a perfect example that I use, like when I'm trying to explain to the confirmation students about purple versus red. You look at our hymnals. What color is that?
Maroon.
Yeah, exactly. Maroon. Somebody else might call it burgundy. Somebody else might call it purple. Somebody else could say, well, it's really a deep, dark red, like a dried red. Well, that's the case here, too. So the color of cape that they put on Jesus, one person would look at it and call it red, and another person would look at it and call it purple. So in reality, I would probably say, yeah, it was maroon, because that's kind of red and purple altogether.
It was a royal color.
It was a royal color, and that's part of it, too. Purple was a royal color, red was a royal color.
Yeah.
So in either case, whether it was pure red or pure purple, which I would say it wasn't either, it was a mixture or a blend of red and purple, it was royal color, and so it was meant to, the soldiers were having fun with Jesus. They were mocking him. Verse 3, they came up to him and said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. The fact that it says struck him with their hands, they were probably slapping him, not punching him. But they were calling him King of the Jews. Now that again is mocking. That's supposedly the charge being brought against him by the Jewish leaders, is that he claims to be king. Well, and that would be an offense to the Roman authority, of course. So that's part of the problem of the charge here. So the soldiers are mocking him. If he's a king, then why are we able to do this to you? Smack. And they would slap him. We also know from the other Gospels, it's a detail left out here in the Gospel of John. Again, this is okay. Different details help authenticate all of them as being authentic. In the other Gospels, we know they also put a reed in his hand that would look like a scepter. And then they would take the reed and strike him on the head with it, which would pound the crown of thorns in even deeper. Now that detail's left out here, but that doesn't really matter to the greater point of the story here. So the Romans, they despise Jews. Just as the Jews despise the Romans too. But the Romans thought of the Jews and other non-Romans as well as barbaric. They weren't civilized like us Romans are civilized. So we can treat them as lesser human beings. And they did. So they actually had used it kind of as sport. How many of you have seen The Passion of the Christ? I know I've asked that question before. Three of you? You have it? You have it? It's a brutal movie. It shows the flogging and the crucifixion in all of its gory reality. And it really is pretty authentic. And if you see that movie, there's two Roman soldiers that are charged with flogging Jesus, and they're laughing while they do it. I think that's authentic too. They would have been doing that. Because they saw Jews as animals, barbaric. They didn't care. And the Jews hated the Romans as well. And it wasn't just Jews, it was non-Romans. But anyway. Alright, verse 4. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So see, Pilate is still trying to get Jesus released. And he's showing, after Jesus has been flogged, and he's wearing the crown of thorns and the robe, and also has a reed in his hand as a scepter, and Pilate is displaying Jesus to the crowd. Now he's battered and bruised and bloodied, and there's flesh torn on his body, and he's showing them that, "See, I find no guilt in him." This is pointing out a couple of things. First of all, if he were guilty, he would have confessed to whatever he were guilty of by now, because he's been beaten so badly. You can take any man past his breaking point and they'll confess. Secondly, he's showing that, Jesus is, he's been punished. So we don't need to punish him any further. He's been punished severely. Why do we need to take the last step of punishment and crucify him? So that's what Pilate is saying here. Verse 5, so Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. There's the color purple again. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Now, this is a very well-known statement. You guys have heard or seen this before. In Greek, it's idu ha anthropos, anthropos being man. In Latin, when it was translated into Latin, and maybe you've heard this phrase, because it appears here and there on, like, art depictions of Jesus. Ecce homo. You heard that? Maybe you haven't. Okay. Well, that's what it is in Latin, ecce homo, which is probably what Pilate said, speaking in Latin. Although, he did know Greek as well. Most of their conversations were in Greek. "Behold the man." So there's Jesus standing. Pilate says, "I find no guilt in him. Behold the man." Now again, there's layers of meaning here. Because first of all, he's saying, for those of you in the crowd that declare this is your Messiah, he's not. He's a mere man. Look at, we've whipped him and he's bleeding. That's no God. Gods don't bleed. Okay? Also, he's saying, if this is the king of the Jews, look it, he's a mere man. As king of the Jews, we've punished him severely with the flogging. So behold the man. Now, I think Pilate again is saying this, behold the man, he's a mere man, we don't need to do anything more, he's not your Messiah, I'm just going to let him go. So he's trying to appeal to the general crowd, as opposed to the Jewish leaders who are incensed. Now when the Jewish leaders hear this, I think it makes them even more enraged. So they incite the crowd even more so. But this phrase, "behold the man," I think is Pilate's attempt to speak to the crowd past the Jewish leaders who are trying to kind of controlling the conversation. Here's the extra deep meaning in this. Is Jesus the man? Yeah. The man. He is God. But the fact that he's standing there bleeding, bloodied, battered, it shows that Jesus is a man. He took on human flesh. And he is the embodiment of the man. all humanity. All humanity is absorbed and contained within Jesus in that moment. He is taking the punishment that all of us deserve. And he is the man. Do you see that deeper meaning? Isn't that incredible and profound? Behold, the man. Pilate didn't know what he was saying. But what he was saying was quite profound. Yes, he is your Messiah, but behold, he's a man. The man. I love that. The deeper profundity of the Gospel of John. Verse 6. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" So see, it's the chief priests. Jesus comes out. Pilate says, "Behold the man." He's trying to get the crowds to sympathize with Jesus, but the chief priests and the officers, they're the instigators here. They're stirring up the crowd towards a riot. And they cry out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." See, there again, Pilate's still trying to release Jesus. See, here's the problem with Pilate. So, was it somebody in this class or the other class that asked me, is Pilate really guilty here of condemning Jesus? Was that in this class? No, the other class maybe? Was you? And I think yes, because what would a true leader do? A true leader would say, "I know Jesus is innocent. I need to release him even though the crowds are going to be upset with me. Even though the Jewish leaders are going to be mad at me. He needs to be released." That's the truth. That's justice. Pilate knew what the truth was. And yet, he caved in to the pressure of the crowds and the Jewish leaders. "Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law. And according to the law, to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." Now there's a messianic term, Son of God, and it also is a reference to being a God, a divine being. So Pilate is polytheist, so this makes him scared. Yeah, Jeannie, you had your hand up?
Didn't Jesus almost always call himself the Son of Man?
Yes, that was his common phrase for himself, was Son of Man, which is an Old Testament title and is a reference to the Messiah, but it's much more vague and much more subtle. And people would wonder, what does that mean, Son of Man? What does he quite mean by that? So yes, Jesus was a little bit more vague and hidden by calling himself the Son of Man. So yes, Son of God is a profound title. According to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God. So here we finally have the truth from the Jewish leaders. Pilate finally knows. When they first brought Jesus to Pilate, what did they say? Pilate says, "Why'd you bring him to me?" And what was their answer? Do you remember? It's really kind of tongue-in-cheek funny. "Well, if he weren't guilty, we wouldn't have brought him to you." So does any judge say, "Oh, okay, you tell me he's guilty, that's fine, he's guilty"? No. You have to investigate and find out what's going on. So I just still think that's funny. That was back in chapter 18. "Well, he's guilty because we brought him to you." No. Then what did they accuse him of? Being king of the Jews. And so that's the problem. Well, that is a problem for the Romans. Now they have to act. Now Pilate has to address this. So that was most of the conversation between Pilate and Jesus. "Are you the king of the Jews? What did you tell me, or did someone else tell you that? You know, blah, blah, blah." Here the truth comes out. Why are the Jews upset about Jesus? Because he made himself to be the Son of God, which actually is the truth. But they don't believe it. Okay? Verse 8, when Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. Why is Pilate afraid? See, this does kind of soften the edge of Pilate a little bit, even though he is guilty. He condemns Jesus, but nevertheless, he was kind of cornered in a political pickle here, and he was kind of a weenie about it. He caved in. Yeah, that's an official word. Why is Pilate more afraid? What is he afraid of, you think?
He could have been afraid of the Roman leaders because they claimed to be God, and there was one of them who called himself the Son of God.
There it is, Caesar.
Caesar.
Yeah. And remember, the Romans were polytheists. They had many gods. Mm-hmm. So I suspect, now again, this is just Pastor Measle reading into it. None of our commentaries really say why Pilate was afraid here. But I think it's a case of Pilate thinking, oh, I've heard the rumors about this guy doing miracles. They don't like him because he claims to be a god, the son of God. What if he's right, and he really is, and I end up condemning one of the divine, one of the gods? You know, it's not Apollos, it's not Mars, but maybe this Jesus is one of those gods, and I condemn him. So I think he is afraid of supernatural consequences. Rightfully so. He should be afraid. So that was good. That shows a little bit of a conscience on Pilate. And yet, he doesn't do anything about it. So, I think he's also afraid of the crowds. Because he was even more afraid of the riot that is beginning to develop. Verse 9, he entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" See, the previous conversation was, "Who are you? Are you king of the Jews?" Well, are you saying that, or did somebody tell you? This is, "Where are you from?" Why does he now ask, "Where are you from?" Are you from the afterlife? Are you from the heavens? Are you from the supernatural realm? Are you the Son of God, as they now just said, that you claim you to be? So that's his, Pilate's questioning just changed, didn't it? He's now concerned about the origin of Jesus, because he's concerned about his own supernatural consequences. Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, verse 10, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." Again, this is such a profound back and forth right here. "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Now, strictly speaking, in an earthly sense, that is true. But who gave, ultimately, who gave Pilate that authority? Where does that come from?
God!
God gives authority to earthly governments to keep the peace. That's part of what Pilate needs to do here, and that's part of his pickle. He's trying to keep the peace. Who is part of God? Jesus. So, unbeknownst to Pilate, the man, the prisoner, standing in front of him is the one who gave him the authority to release him or condemn him. And frankly, Jesus is standing there of his own free will. He's doing it in obedience to God the Father. He could have called down a legion of angels. We know this from other Gospels. He could have called down a legion of angels and freed himself, right? So that question, "Will you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" That's a useless question with Jesus, because, yeah, Jesus knows he has that authority. He's the one who gave it to him. And then Jesus says, "You have no authority unless it had been given you from above." So there Jesus is referencing the supernatural again, the divine. In the case of Jesus and true believers, we know he's talking about God the Father. Pilate is thinking one of the other gods, the polytheism. And then Jesus says, "Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." So that shows Pilate is sinning. He's condemning Jesus. He had Jesus flogged inappropriately. Jesus was innocent, yet he still had Jesus flogged. He's about to have him crucified. He's going to sin there too. But it's a lesser sin, because what is the greater sin? "Who is it that delivered me over to you?" Well, there's two answers.
Does the Greek have different words, like for great, greater, greatest?
Yes.
Do you do in English?
Okay. It does.
So that's
a superlative.
Okay.
Yeah, correct. Who is it that turned Jesus over?
Judas.
I always thought Judas, and that is one of the two answers here. Judas is the one who betrayed Jesus and started the whole thing rolling. Who is the other one that this could refer to? And this I read in the commentary, which I was like, oh yeah, well that's true. Caiaphas, right? Caiaphas was in control. He's the one who kind of initiated it all by hiring Judas to go arrest Jesus to begin with. So Caiaphas also has the greater sin. So, and there is debate even in Lutheran circles about, is Jesus referring here to Judas or Caiaphas? Well,
I'd say yes.
Yes, exactly. He's kind of both.
Right.
There's enough guilt to go around, right?
Oh, there is enough guilt to go around, absolutely. Yeah. Also, just a little side note. So here's a little mental field trip, side field trip for us. The greater sin. You ever hear Lutherans talk about greater sins and lesser sins? Yeah, but that's different. Greater sins or lesser sins. You don't hear Lutherans talk about it too much. Maybe on a rare occasion, right?
I don't hear Lutherans talk about sins much anymore at all.
Me? I do, yeah.
Or anybody. Yeah, maybe you
don't. Yeah.
In the small catechism, there's the petty anti-thief, and then there's the armchair thieves.
Yeah.
They have the greater armchair guys.
Yeah, Luther does reference the greater versus lesser.
Greater.
I think that Lutherans generally refrain from referring to greater and lesser sins because we've seen the trap that the Roman Catholics got into with venial and mortal sins. And I think it is a trap within Roman Catholic theology. Because what ends up happening is they ended up saying in Catholic theology, well, venial sins you have to take care of. Jesus took care of your mortal sins, your greater sins, but venial sins you have to provide accommodation for or satisfaction for. So you need to do penance, you need to give offerings, you need to say the Our Father or the Hail Mary or, you know, whatever. You need to burn those off. So then they categorize sins. That's one of the flaws of Roman Catholic theology that Luther and Lutherans kind of resist. Categorizing sins.
Come up with purgatory. You have to go to purgatory because you still haven't cleansed all those.
Correct. Those venial sins. That's part, purgatory is part of this idea of grading sins, worse and less worse sins. Can you go to heaven just because you stole a pen from the office? Yes! Would we say that's a lesser sin? Yeah, I think most of us would. Here's the bigger practical reason, I think, for me as a Lutheran pastor and other Lutheran pastors. If I were to start teaching more openly about greater sins and lesser sins, what's going to naturally happen in the human brain? Oh, well, I just committed lesser sins. I'm not like those serial murderers out there. I'm not like Adolf Hitler out there. I didn't commit greater sins. I just committed lesser sins. So I'm not as bad. So God will love me and get me into heaven because I'm not as bad as those. Is that true? There's a smidgen of truth there. Maybe in your mind, you're not as bad as those. However, all it takes is one sin of the smallest caliber. Frankly, we all have sinful nature embedded within us. So even if you never actually commit a sin, you're still sinful. So that's why we don't talk about greater and lesser sins, because I think it distracts people from the truth that we need to just confess all sins. Doesn't matter if they're greater sins or lesser sins. However, just amongst us chickens, there is such a thing as greater and lesser sins. Jesus talks about it. We have to remember, though, that all sins condemn. So don't fall into that trap. All of you are well catechized and strong, faithful, and loyal Lutherans and Christians. So we just need to remember to say to ourselves, I can't view myself as not as bad as the other guy. Because we are all bad. We all sin in various ways, greater or lesser.
When Jesus is saying here, he has the greater sin, I think he's thinking of the Sanhedrin and they met, you know, and condemned him. But isn't it true, I have heard or read somewhere, that the Sanhedrin's rules required them all to be in attendance?
I believe that's true.
And it was to be a daytime attendance?
Yes.
Not just undercover.
So really, the Sanhedrin was acting outside their own rules and laws. Yes, they had to all be there, and it had to be in the daytime, so it was open and public, so that it wasn't secretive. and yet the Sanhedrin did not have everybody there, and they met during the middle of the night. So yes, it was a, I don't know what you would say, illegitimate conviction by the Sanhedrin. Yeah.
And it says chief priests sometimes. Does that mean the Sanhedrin?
You know, I think that means the Sadducees, who were the priests. The Sanhedrin was had Sadducees in it, it had Pharisees in it, and it had political Jewish leaders in it. So it was a mix. It was a controlling council.
Scribes
were in there as well. So it had a few of a bunch of different categories of Jews. So it's not strictly chief priests. So when you hear it say in the Bible, in the Gospels, chief priests, that may have generally been referring to the Sanhedrin, but probably more specific, it's referring to the Sadducees, because they were the priests.
And was Zacchaeus a part of the Sanhedrin?
No. Zacchaeus, he was a tax collector. He was viewed on the same rung as a prostitute, and that meaning the lowest rung.
That's not what I'm thinking of, I'm sorry. Nicodemus.
Oh, Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a Pharisee, and he was on the Sanhedrin.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Chosen series, I think he's being portrayed as becoming a believer.
Yes. And I think that's accurate. Mm-hmm. He's the one who came to Jesus secretly by night and asked him about birth. And Jesus said, unless you're born again.
Yeah.
And Nicodemus, along with Joseph of Arimathea. Yeah. So those two are both Jewish leaders. And they're in the Sanhedrin, and those two, we believe strongly that they were likely followers and believers in Jesus, because what did they do? They are the ones who took down Jesus' body and buried it. So yes, I think it's accurate in The Chosen that they're showing Nicodemus moving towards becoming a believer in Jesus. I think that's accurate. It's a decent series. It's fairly accurate.
And that series, when he meets with Jesus secretly at night, is wonderfully portrayed in...
I have not seen that episode. I've only seen season one. I gotta catch up. I know it's on season four right now, maybe?
It's in season two or three, but four is being released, I think, in February.
Okay, alright. Have you guys all seen The Chosen? Or you've at least heard of it? No, you haven't? You have?
Yeah.
Some of it. It's good. It's a good series.
Also, I think the greater sin is they totally reject Jesus, right? What's the most...
Yeah.
Unforgivable sin that they talk about in the Bible is completely rejecting Jesus, which
right.
is what they're doing.
Yes. That's a good point. I had never thought of that before. He who has delivered me over to you is the greater sin. The greater sin being outright rejection of Jesus.
The first commandment.
Yeah, it's a first commandment sin. Exactly right. You know, that's a great point. See, this is why I love teaching. You guys teach me just like I teach you. That's a great point. Thank you. All right, anything else on that? All right, moving on. See, here we are again. Then, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. So Pilate still, for the next however long, 5, 10, 15 minutes, or whatever's going on here, this is kind of the final stand, Pilate is still trying to calm the crowd down so that he can release Jesus without himself getting into, you know, a mess. So from then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. Now this is a loaded phrase, because Caesar's friend was actually an official term in the Roman government. You could only achieve a certain rank in the bureaucracy or in the government if you were designated, quote unquote, Caesar's friend. And who could designate you that way? Caesar himself. So it was Caesar's way, and this was started, I don't know by which Caesar, Augustus, Julius, one of them, where he would put his stamp on somebody and say, you are Caesar's friend. Boom. That means that person was eligible to be appointed to the highest echelons of the government. Okay? You with me? A little bit of Roman government history. Pilate had been so designated because, I think I put it in my notes here, hang on just a second. Say Janus is a Roman general who recommended Pontius Pilate be appointed to the position of governor in Judea. Say Janus, a Roman general, recommended Pilate to Caesar. So Pilate is a political appointee. Here's a little bit more of Roman history. I just read it in a commentary, so, you know, I don't take credit for knowing this. Say Janus, some number of years after that, those events, was executed for insurrection and rebellion against Caesar. What does that mean for Pilate? What is Caesar now going to think of Pilate? Well, I had this great general over here, and he recommended that guy, who Pilate was in the military, he recommended that guy be a governor over there in Judea. So, yeah, okay, I'll make you governor. And then some number of years later, say Janus is caught in a scheme of insurrection, so he's executed by Caesar. What does that make Caesar think of Pilate? Ooh, Pilate's on thin ice, isn't he? So when the Jews make this statement, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend, that actually is a very loaded, weighted phrase and accusation. They're basically hinting, if you don't do what we want, we're going to spread the word that you are not Caesar's friend, and when the word gets back to Caesar, he's going to depose you, maybe even execute you. That's a threat. That's an implied threat right there from the Jewish leaders to Pontius Pilate. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. Wow. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. All right, let's see. Do I have some notes on that? Did I skip something? Oh, no. It's coming up. So, there's a place outside called the Stone Pavement. We have no idea what that is or where that is. But obviously, at the time John wrote this gospel, the people then still knew what this location was. Must have been a place of judgment or you know, like a judge's bench kind of thing, like we would say today. Verse 14, now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, behold your king. Now here's, again, there's a lot in these verses right here. We are in the thick of it. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. Wait a second. Didn't Jesus eat the Passover with his disciples on Thursday night? And here it is, the sixth hour on Friday morning. The sixth hour would be what time?
Noon,
exactly right. Because they would count the day starting at 6 a.m. when the sun rose, approximately. Yes, it would vary maybe half an hour. They're closer to the equator. But the sun would rise. The variation of the sun rising by season is less extreme than it is here farther north. So, yes, it was approximately 6 o'clock is the zero hour. So the sixth hour is noon. High noon, middle of the day. On Good Friday. Didn't Jesus eat the Passover? Why does it say preparation of the Passover? We talked about this a couple times ago, didn't we? About the timing of events?
Wouldn't preparation day be the day before?
Correct.
Passover?
Exactly.
So wouldn't that be Wednesday?
Correct. In a strict understanding of that phrase, that's absolutely correct. Now, I looked this up in the Greek. Greek has very little punctuation. There are periods, there are commas, and there are quotes, and that's about it. Oh no, there are no commas. There are periods, and there are quotation marks, and there are question marks, and that's about it. There are no commas. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. This could be read, now it was the day of preparation, comma, the Passover. There is no word of in there. Okay? So, if somebody, again, I'm kind of pointing this out just as a little bit of apologetics, if somebody again says, well, see, the Gospels don't agree with each other. They don't even agree within their own Gospel, because Jesus celebrated the Passover with his disciples Thursday night, which the Jews would count as the same as Friday day. Because for the Jews, the day started at sunset. For the Romans, the day started at sunrise. Okay, so it was the day of preparation. The Passover. That's how that could be read. So the day of preparation for what? What actually is Saturday?
Sabbath.
So is this the day of preparation for the Sabbath?
No.
That's what I think. I think that, and again, there is some vagueness here. We don't know, and scholars kind of debate this. I think this is John the Apostle saying, this is the day of preparation for the Sabbath, and it is the Passover. That because we don't have the punctuation in the original Greek, it reads this way, preparation of the Passover. Now, this could be a correct translation if John the Apostle, when he says Passover, is referring to the entire week-long Passover celebration. So much like we would refer to Christmas. When you refer to Christmas, when we refer to Christmas, you might mean Christmas Day. When you refer to Christmas, you might mean the season of Christmas, which for us in the church starts on Christmas Day and goes till Epiphany. But in our culture, when does the season of Christmas begin?
October.
Yeah, right. Came around Halloween, right? and then the season of, so the Jews did the same thing. Passover could refer to the day of Passover, or it could refer to the week after Passover as the celebration continued. So, this could be John saying it was the day of preparation for the week of Passover. He doesn't say week, but maybe he meant that to be implied. Or, this could mean it was the day of preparation, parentheses, for the Sabbath, and it's the Passover day. It's the Passover. It was the day of preparation, the Passover. That's my preferred understanding of this, but it could be the other way as well. Okay?
The Passover didn't always fall on a Sabbath, though, did it?
Correct.
Okay.
It did not.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it would vary. Mm-hmm. The Passover was a strict counting of days, versus the Sabbath was always the seventh day of the week. Sometimes they would coincide, and sometimes they wouldn't. You're absolutely right. It was about the sixth hour, so yes, noon. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." Oh my goodness, what did he just say? Just a matter of whatever, 10, 20 minutes prior to this. Behold the man, which has a lot of weight to it. This also, behold your king. He's not my king, well we know that. Pilate, you're not a believer. Behold your king. They cried out, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Again, is there a truth statement in there?
No.
Yes, there is. In the Old Testament, God told his people that he was their king. He was their God, he was their Lord, he was their king. And the people wanted an earthly king. You remember that? And God said to them through the prophet, I forget which one, Elijah? No, it was before.
Samuel.
Yes, Samuel. God said to them through Samuel, "No, you don't want a king. He's going to tax you. He's going to draft your young men into the army. He's going to dictate to you, you know, what you can build and where you can go and all this kind of stuff. You don't want a king." "Yes, we want a king. All the nations around us have a king." So God relented through the prophet Samuel, and who was the first king of Israel?
Saul,
who was a nasty king. Turned out to be a bad king, right? So, and the reason for all of that is God did specifically say to them, "He is their king. You don't need a king. I'm your king. You don't need to be like all those other nations around you." Well, the chief priests knew all of that history of the Jewish nation. And here they say, "We have no king but Caesar." What are they unknowingly doing? Denouncing God as their king. Is God our king? Yeah, he is our king. We don't have a need of an earthly king. We have God for our king. They should have recognized they have God as their king. Now they're trying to make a statement before Pilate, and unknowingly they make a truth statement with a hidden meaning. They have no king. It's true. They have rejected God, Yahweh, the true God, and they only recognize Caesar as a king over them.
I think Pilate's playing them too. I think Pilate's causing them to make themselves subjects to Caesar.
I would agree.
Okay, I'll crucify this guy, but you guys gotta...
take the rap.
You are my subjects now.
Yes. Remember in the Gospel of Matthew, so here again, it's you know, it's nice that we have the four Gospels. We can merge details together. It's only in Matthew, not here. What does Pilate do at this point?
Washes
his hands. The blood of this man is not on me, and he washes his hands in front of them. And what do they say?
His blood be on
us and our children. Great memory. Absolutely. So yes, I think Pilate, there is a little bit of Pilate playing some politics with them as well,
yeah.
Forcing them to take responsibility and forcing them to admit they're under his authority.
Yeah, because they didn't believe that Pilate had any authority over them.
Correct.
Because he was a Gentile.
Correct. Yes. So yes, Pilate was an astute politician. So yeah, he's playing games with them just like they are with him.
Yeah.
And all of it is wrong. All of them know Jesus is innocent. And yet the Jews want Jesus dead because they don't believe he's the Messiah. Pilate ends up conceding and giving Jesus over to death because he doesn't want the headache and the political problems and the bad reputation with Caesar, who he's already on thin ice with, Caesar. So yeah, they're all in the wrong. There's guilt to go around, as you said earlier.
He's just trying to pacify the crowd so there's not a rebellion, and then he would be booted out.
That's correct.
Yeah.
He's pacifying the crowds. And who's stirring up the crowds? The Jewish leaders. Verse 16, so he delivered him over to them to be crucified. Who's the him? Jesus, of course. He delivered him over to them to be crucified. Now that doesn't mean he said, okay, you take him and crucify him yourself. No, it means he delivered him over to their will. He agreed with them to have Jesus crucified. Who actually performed the crucifixion? The Roman soldiers. If Pilate actually delivered him over to Jesus and said to the Jews, if Pilate actually delivered Jesus over to the Jews and said, okay, go ahead, you have my permission, because they needed Roman permission, you can execute him, what would they have done? They would have stoned him. So it was the Roman soldiers who were the ones who actually executed Jesus to be crucified. So when it says Pilate delivered Jesus over to them, it simply means he gave in, he caved in to their will. He gave up and said, okay, I'll do what you want. Well, actually, playing these political games, who's in authority over who then? Glenn, as you were saying, Pilate is trying to show the Jews are under his authority, and yet what does Pilate do? He caves into their desires and their wants, almost kind of indicating they have authority. There really is a political struggle going on here between Pilate and the Jewish leaders. That's absolutely true. And really, that's as far as I got in the Wednesday class last week. So I know, you know, we're about 5 minutes short of an hour or so. Just to finish the verse, why they put the verse reference there, I don't know. But the end of verse 16 is, so they took Jesus. See it right there. So then next time when we pick up, we'll start out with verse 17. He went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull. That's where we'll pick up next time. Okay. Any other questions or comments? You guys have had some good observations for me.
What's interesting, like you're talking about with Samuel, with King Saul, I remember when reading it where, you know, Samuel was upset and he said, God tells him, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me.
That's true. Right. Yes. Yeah. Samuel was like, what are you guys doing asking for a king? Samuel was a faithful prophet.
Right.
You guys shouldn't be doing that. And God tells Samuel, don't worry about it. They're rejecting me, not you. Yeah. Good point. Good point. Anything else?
It just befuddles me that the chief priests, the scholars, the biblical authorities would say, we have no king but Caesar.
That is,
they caved in big time.
They did. And they knew the history of the Jewish people in the Old Testament. They knew that God was, God said he is their king. And they're saying, we have no king. Yes, that is befuddling. I actually think sometimes the more knowledge you get, the more difficult it is to maintain an innocent faith. That we get mired in the details of things. You know, Jesus says it's the faith of a child. Simple faith. And I see this in myself sometimes, and I see that in others, in our church and in our church body. The more knowledge we gain, sometimes it becomes a little more of a struggle to maintain that innocent faith. Because now all of a sudden God, why did this happen to them? Well, God, I want to do it this way. Why are you opening doors over there? I want this over here. We start to question and debate and argue with God. And I think some of that is due to the fact that we gain more understanding of the Bible, which we should study the Bible. So I don't want to sound like I'm against that. We need to study the Bible, but somehow in there we need to also maintain that innocence of faith. And that can be a difficult thing. And yes, I think the Jewish leaders, they were so mired in the details of their knowledge. You know, the statement, you can't see the forest for the trees. They're looking at the details and forgetting the big picture. This is Jesus, the Messiah. Now, not all of them, though. Because we know of at least two. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, who were believers in Jesus, followers of Jesus. So not all of them fall into that trap. All right.
But weren't they secret followers?
Yeah. Right. They should have been open followers, not secret followers. You're right. That shows a weakness of faith.
Is there a lesson here, too, about mixing politics and, well, church and state, politics and religion?
I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, there probably is a lesson in there about mixing politics and religion. You're right.
Nothing good can come from that.
Nothing good can come from that. Lutherans are on the forefront of that, right? Martin Luther, absolutely, right from the beginning.
Mixing religion and
not mixing religion and politics, right? Because prior to him, the Catholic Church was all involved in the affairs of the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and the emperor was all involved in trying to dictate who would be bishops and cardinals and pope. So they were all involved in each other's business. And Luther came along, and of course they rejected him from both sides, both the emperor and the pope, for different reasons. But Luther said, no, let the emperor rule over earthly matters, and let the church rule over spiritual matters. And he was right. That's a proper division. Started right there with Luther. The two kingdoms, right? You guys have heard the two kingdoms. Yeah, there probably is a lesson buried in here about mixing politics and religion.
Well, the problem is they take it too far, and that they think you're not supposed to have any religion in government at all. You're
right.
Not supposed to pray, not supposed to do anything, and that's not...
That's correct. That's going too far.
Right.
Yes, Christian morality should still inform political government.
Right.
So government should still be aligned with proper godly morality. Yes. So going too far, you can go too far. Yeah, Joyce, are you going to say something?
Well, I was just thinking that when they gave Jesus the coin...
Yes. Should we pay taxes? And he said, well, show me a coin.
Yes, that gives a division.
It does. That gives a division right there. Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it really didn't come from Luther. It came from Jesus.
Luther just found it.
Exactly.
And it's possible, too, for the church to get too political.
It is. Totally possible, the church to get too involved in politics.
Too legalistic or too political.
Oh, within ourselves. Yeah.
Secular.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right. Yeah, you guys should vote for me. I'm the best pastor. Vote for me over the other pastors. Yeah, no, we're not getting political like that, right? That's tongue-in-cheek, but... Because I already know I'm the best pastor. No. All right. Well, this will be the last class until January 9th. I was planning on restarting after just a couple weeks, restarting January 2nd and 3rd, and I may have said that back some number of weeks ago. But now that Jill and I have gotten tickets to go watch Elliot and the Rose Parade, I won't be getting back until the 3rd of January from California, so we are not going to meet that week. We'll start again, both Tuesday and Wednesday. We'll be in sync. We'll start again in the middle of chapter 19 where we are. So January 9th and 10th, Tuesday, Wednesday. And it looks to me like we have about 4 to 6 weeks and we'll finish John. And that'll be right about the time that Lent happens. So then we'll start talking about the art of dying next. So a little preview, teaser about that. I'm actually kind of excited about it. I'll learn about the art of dying. Yes, Glenn.
Don't be in a hurry.
Don't be in a hurry, that's right. It'll all happen to all of us, right? All right. Well, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good evening, and Merry Christmas.